Good morning, everybody. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on today. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to pick up from where Stefan left off and begin by just giving you a view of how NGOs, particularly in my sector, the international development NGOs, are starting to see the coming decades. I'm then going to talk how we see the SDGs and talk a little bit about some things that we'll be doing in Australia around awareness raising and accountability. But to pick up from Stefan, there's, simplifying things, two schools of thought about the future of human development, given those seven megatrends that Stefan presented. There's two good books that capture these two different perspectives as well. One by Jonathan Spence, The Next Convergence, describes that Silk Road scenario of the shift, the pivot to Asia and the growing economies there, the rapid increase in human development, and indeed often the success of the MDGs in actually halving the number of people living in extreme poverty has been attributed to the rapid economic growth, economic development in China in particular, in lifting some 400 million people out of extreme poverty over the last 30 years. And Spence goes forward and says, well, China's and India's economy, you know, the populations are about 60% of the world population, their per capita income is much, much lower, but by the time their per capita income equals, say, that of Australia's, their economies, the combined economies, will be four or five times larger than the European Union and North America and Japan combined. So that will happen in the course of this century. And Spence is a Nobel Prize winner for economists. He's a conventional economist in the sense that he believes in the famous economist Schumpeter's dictum of constructive, creative destruction. So that new technologies, new forms of production will impinge upon old forms of economic production, and those technologies will be very, very expensive in the beginning, but then as you get more and more investment coming in, the costs come down and they proliferate around the world. And so he says really intractable problems like climate change, the technology is there, it's still very expensive. We heard about the batteries from Stefan, but over time he has faith that science and technology and economic theorem, Schumpeter's theorem, basically will prevail and humanity will be able to deal with the problems that beset us and are encapsulated in some of the SDGs. So essentially it's an optimistic view of the world. There's another book by another economist, Tim Jackson, called Prosperity Without Growth. Jackson was on the Gordon Brown's, the UK government's sustainability commission some years ago. And that commission actually did a report called Prosperity Without Growth. He has a more sceptical view. He was a conventional economist, but he's looked at the trends that Stefan has looked at, and he says, look, they simply don't stack up. So he says, between 1950 and 2000, the global economy grew five times, and we can all think of the rapid advances in our own prosperity over the last decades and the leaps in technology. But he says, if the world economy continues to grow at roughly 2% each year for the rest of the century, by the end of this century, it will be 80 times bigger than it was in 1950. And he says, ask the question simply, what does a global economy of that scale consume? Where will all the natural resources come from to feed that level, that size of global consumption? He says it doesn't stack up. It's not logically possible. And despite innovations in recycling that Stefan pointed out, he says when you put it up against other problems of increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we have some very, very significant challenges that call for radical changes in human behaviour, and that has to be driven by a whole range of actors on a policy front. So those two books I recommend to you. So come to the NGOs. How are we starting to see the world? Well, increasingly we're seeing the next few decades being framed by a number of key broad themes. So one is environmental objectives, the second is inequality, thirdly is indignity, and these broad headings, there'll be a whole lot of different work going on for different types of organisations in specific areas. So around climate adaptation, disaster risk reduction, fair access to natural resources, good governance, ethical global business, and there'll be a honing in, but the dominant tenor of the NGO sector will be increasingly focused on make or break survival issues for humanity in this century. And the problems of environment, of inequality, migration, natural disasters will be the dominant themes that you'll be hearing more and more, certainly from the large non-government organisations in my sector. Just to touch on some of those themes, inequality. So we've seen the successes in reducing absolute poverty under the MDGs, but there's been a historic shift with the rise of those middle-income countries. Back in 1990, 93% of the world's population that were extremely poor were living in least developed countries. Now, three-quarters of the world's 1.3 billion people that live in extreme poverty live in middle-income countries, broadly defined by the World Bank. So that presents opportunities and challenges. The opportunity, of course, is those states have more resources, more revenues, more investment to actually help lift people out of poverty and distribute redistribute wealth across the economy to reach the poor. So that's the opportunity. However, as we've seen in India, which has more billionaires per capita than any other country in the world, they still have a very intractable problem of 450 million people living in extreme poverty. And it could, you'd rightfully assume that despite that 9% rates of economic growth there, that it's going to take many, many decades to reduce that number of people living in extreme poverty. With violence, you'll see that NGOs will be more and more focused on different forms of violence, not just armed conflicts. So notwithstanding the problems of Syria and the enormous number of refugees that have spilled into neighbouring countries, NGOs will be focused on law and order issues, and they'll be linking these to environmental and inequality issues where there is conflict or violence around access to natural access to resources. Violence due to social inclusion, and we'll also be looking more and more at transnational crime and social conflict around extractive industries, mining and the like. We'll be looking more and more at migration issues and state resistance to migration of poor peoples. So it'll be a very broad spectrum, but that you'll be hearing more and more about this. And there is some challenges for the traditional work of non-government organisations too, because as these dominant focuses start to take hold, the urgency of the environmental issues, the urgency of the inequality and violence issues, it might crowd out some of those issues that we have been focused on in the development sector during the MDG era around the traditional focuses of education, health and gender equality. So, going forward, where does this bring us in relation to the SDGs? Well, we see the SDGs as very important because it is an intergovernmental agreement that actually, for the first time, establishes a normative framework of bringing development issues together with the sustainability challenges that the planet has. And that's very, very significant. And we applaud the work of the UN and particularly Amina Mohammed in driving this agenda. The process has been consultative and there has been a wide range of consultation in many, many states with civil society, both through the UN, the UN processes, but also sometimes between governments and civil society and then through that process into the UN. And certainly in Australia, we've had two channels. There has been a formal input in through the UN consultation processes. There's also been input through AusAid and then the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade through my organisation, and we're very appreciative of that. The issues that the NGOs were particularly concerned about in the Australian context when we started canvassing views were around environmental sustainability, gender equality, disability inclusion, which 1 in 10 people on the planet have some form of disability, and so often in developing countries, people with disabilities are the most marginalised and may have multiple intersections of where they may be have a disability, they may be female, they may be Indigenous, and so there's compounded their exclusion or marginalisation in society because of those identities. Disaster risk reduction, particularly linked to the challenges of climate change, and the issues of a rights-based approach, which means that holding governments to account for both delivery of services, basic services, distributing wealth across society to tackle inequality, and providing a framework for peace and security. So these were the issues that non-government organisations, Australian citizens working in those organisations and working with their partners, NGOs in developing countries, were particularly concerned about. I'd like to talk a little bit about how NGOs are going to be moving forward with the SDG agenda. So Natasha talked about the sort of the lag in public awareness or take up around the MDGs, and that was certainly true here in Australia. It wasn't until 2005 that the Make Poverty History campaign was created, and for any of you of a certain generation that went through that, there were probably people in their 30s now, but were 20 in their late teens or 20s then. There were big concerts in Australia, there was wristbands, there was a high level of public awareness raising about the generation that would be able to solve or halve the number of people living in poverty by 2015. And there was a big mobilisation, and of course Kevin Rudd in our own political system in 2006 took that youth constituency up. It was also a very popular cause in churches and made it part of his platform. And so probably for the first time in many, many decades, the issue of Australian aid and saving, tackling global poverty was made an electoral issue, and you could argue Rudd made it up there and, you know, one of the top 10 issues that would be during that particular election. That situation has obviously reversed at this point in time. But the significance of that mass mobilisation indicates what can be done around public awareness arising around the SDGs. The SDGs doesn't roll off the tongue, the 17 don't roll off the tongue, and it's going to need to be communicated and conveyed in different ways. Some of the campaign techniques used during the Make Poverty History era, both in Australia but globally, were getting famous rock stars doing, you know, every second a child dies, but, you know, we can do something about this. So you need communications, advertising people to actually come in and think of ways that can simply convey what the SDGs mean and what the opportunity is for ordinary people to get involved and support them. But the evidence is there that when there's a concerted effort, those communication techniques can be very, very effective. However, we're starting at a really, really low level of public awareness. There has been some surveying of public awareness of the SDGs in the US, UK and Germany. And basically, awareness at this point, and realising they haven't been signed, but there has been preparation about them and they're building off the MDGs, public awareness is really below 10%, often around about 5% or less in those countries. Germany was the highest, and when the SDGs were explained, the survey in the US found a degree of cynicism that these goals could be achieved by 2030. And it shifted in different countries. Germany was the most optimistic that these goals could be, substantial progress could be made. In Australia, we don't have a comparable survey. All we have is a proxy, which is the Vote Compass results from the 2013 election and then subsequent polling. So if you take support for the Australian Aid Program and what it tries to do in terms of tackling global poverty and some of the and saying, well, look, this is a proxy because it's aligned with many of the goals in the SDGs, not all of them, obviously, then what it shows is that the blue bits, which are concentrated in the eastern states and urban areas, is where support for tackling international poverty is the highest. It's highest amongst 18 to 35-year-olds living in inner-city electorates. The ACT support is the most supportive of all parts of Australia for tackling international poverty, and having an aid program as a, again, as a proxy to do that. Those against increasing tackling overseas poverty or increasing the aid budget, again, a proxy, which is the brown states. You can see there, Queensland, or regional Queensland, pretty intractable there. I know the previous parliamentary secretary used to talk about Mount Isa Man as the litmus test of whether there was support for international development efforts. We think that's the wrong starting point. You do not start with the most attractable opponents of working to tackle global problems in Mount Isa. We think that probably the starting point is to go into those blue bits and go into the 18 to 35 year old demographic, but I would also say there's a second demographic, which is people in the 50 to 80 year old age group, which are large, but particularly retirees, people that actually have a lot of time, they know how the political system works, they're interested in the world, they've travelled the world, and they want to do something, and they want to hold politicians accountable. We think there's a lot of opportunity there to engage them on the SDGs. So, in Australia, there's a new campaign, the Australian Aid Campaign, which has come out as a result of the when the government broke its promise, election promise, and cut the aid program. But this campaign will be focusing, as of September, on the SDGs going into next year. So they'll be communicating to their supporters. It started in February. There's 64,000 people that have signed up already. So there will be this push to communicate out to that constituency electronically, and you can join, what the SDGs are, what they mean, and what you can do to get active on them. My own organisation, we're going to be doing some work up in Parliament House next month with Chris Woodthorpe at the UN Information Centre, which will be holding a forum with Steve Chiobo, the Past Sec for Foreign Affairs, Tanya Plibersek, so they can explain the government and the opposition's views on the SDGs. And we're also going to be working with the UN Sustainability Network in Melbourne and Sydney, holding public forums and workshops with NGOs to explain the SDGs there too. So there's a lot that can be done. The final thing to say is the issue of accountability. I know there's a lot of NGOs, a lot of SDGs, but I think that's not an impediment to non-government organisations, because many NGOs will cluster around particular NDGs and the targets and champion them and be talking to government about what government should be doing in particular areas. And I think that's actually, there's a utility in that, that they're more diverse and there's more there that you can work with for different, for civil society at large. The interesting challenge, I think, is around accountability. In talking with DFAT, I think there's a really welcome effort that DFAT are now talking to the Australian Bureau of Statistics to start trying measuring what Australia is going to do to achieve the SDGs. So I think that's going to be very significant in reporting into the UN. There's obviously challenges in developing countries doing that because their data collection is poorer, but it's really, really valuable and important. You have to be able to measure what you are doing. The final thing I wanted to say is that there was an initiative during the development of the SDGs called the Participate Initiative, and it was in developing countries, and it was bringing together very, very poor people, in the case of India, street dwellers, educating them on what the SDGs would be, and then asking them what they thought about them and what they thought should be SDGs. And they considered them, they learned about the MDGs, the SDGs, and they said, you know, in India, we've had plans for years. What we want is an end to impunity and governments ignoring those plans. Thank you.